destruction of its own roots. Those same leaders suggest that we live in a world of destructive chaos, that there is no plan, no progress, no personal accountability. They've argued that we are nothing more than victims of the systems into which we are born. We are inescapably earthbound. There's political benefit to this kind of demagoguery. It allows politicians to proclaim themselves materialist messiahs, prepared to save us from uncaring fate. The last time this kind of thinking was widespread, there was no Western civilization, and it's easier to return to the status quo ante than any of us will admit. God's ordered universe. Before there was God, there were gods. It is difficult for most Westerners to conceive of the notion of multiple gods nowadays, because the Judeo-Christian God has loomed so large for millennia. But the vast majority of religions prior to Judaism were polytheistic. That's not because polytheists were fools. It's actually because polytheism is sophisticated and natural in many ways. Polytheism is sophisticated in its willingness to absorb new, strange gods. The ancient Egyptians, Greeks, and Romans were polytheists and would routinely incorporate the gods of other religions into their own religion. As the famed British Orientalist Henry William Frederick Sags points out, accepting a polytheistic view of life, the ancients were under no pressure to deny the existence of the gods of other peoples. Difficulties only surfaced when one group assertively denied the very existence of other gods. This was the case with the Jews, who in consequence became the least tolerant of all ancient peoples. Paganism also recognizes that the universe is a chaotic place, one we can't fully understand. A prime mover, a singular god instead of myriad gods, would require that logic govern the universe, a predictable set of rules discernible by the human mind. There are no such obvious rules. Therefore, the universe must be an interplay of various minds battling with one another for supremacy. Pagan religion creation stories demonstrate colorfully how such beliefs manifest. The Mesopotamian creation story, which is similar to both Polynesian and Native American creation stories in a wide variety of ways, states that Apsu, god of the fresh water, was murdered, and that his wife, Tiamat, goddess of salt water, threatened to destroy the other gods. Marduk murdered her and split her in half. One half of her became heaven, the other half became the earth. The plethora of gods were created to explain a world without rules. In that way, polytheism is more pessimistic and more cynical than Judeo-Christian monotheism. Finally, polytheism is rooted in a hard-headed belief in that which we can see. As former British Chief Rabbi Jonathan Sacks points out, the pagan perceives the divine in nature through the medium of the eye. The simplest explanation for a multitude of objects is a multitude of creators. Or, more simply, God is nature and nature God, a pantheistic notion that continues to resonate down until today in spiritual but not religious circles, as well as in many Eastern religions. The Mesopotamians worshipped literally thousands of gods and built massive ziggurats that were supposed to provide an earthly abode for the gods. Idols were built for the gods to inhabit, and the gods were worshipped through service, including feeding them on a regular basis. The Egyptians had a different creation myth based in each major city, and a plethora of gods as well. Judaism denied all these central tenets of polytheism. Judaism claimed that God was now singular. The first of the Ten Commandments was simple and direct. I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. God was the first and the last, the creator. Furthermore, Judaism claimed that God had rules, and that he abided by those rules. The universe wasn't random. The rules were generally discoverable and largely understandable. The Bible isn't a set of just-so stories designed to explain why the rain falls and the sun shines. Instead, the Bible lays forth for the first time an argument for the internal logic of the universe. God, according to the Bible, worked through a singular unified system. Nature operated according to a set of predictable rules from which God could stray if he so chose. In Genesis, for example, the patriarch Abraham asks God to abide by his own rules for right and wrong. When God says he wants to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah, Abraham argues with God over right and wrong, and asks God whether collective punishment is appropriate if there are good people still living in the city. God answers him. God doesn't merely ignore Abraham or silence him. Rather, he engages with him. In a chaotic world with no master moral values, the story of Abraham would make no sense. Now, Judaism does not claim that we are capable of understanding all of God's motives or actions. In Exodus, Moses specifically asks God to show him his face. God refuses, answering, "I will cause all my goodness to pass in front of you, and I will proclaim my name, the Lord, in your presence. I will have mercy on whom I will have mercy, and I will have compassion on whom I will have compassion. But you cannot see my face, for no one may see me and live." This metaphor is God's way of saying that we humans cannot completely understand God. In fact, as Genesis makes clear, the human notion of good and evil doesn't mirror the divine notions of good and evil. But God does have a standard, even if we can't fully comprehend it. God does not randomly change his standard. He is the rock. His ways are perfect, and all his ways are just. A faithful God who does no wrong, upright and just is he. The notion of a moral universe is a Judaic creation. It's woven into the name of Israel itself. Yisrael, in Hebrew, means struggle with God. And God wants human beings to struggle with him. So much so that he will refuse to intervene to correct human beings even if they are wrong. The Talmud famously retells this shocking incident. During a debate about a matter of Jewish law, Rabbi Eliezer brought all possible proofs to support his opinion, but the rabbis did not accept his answer. Finally, Rabbi Eliezer said, "If the law is in my favor, heaven will prove it." A divine voice then stated, "Why are you arguing with Rabbi Eliezer, as the law is in accordance with his opinion everywhere?" Rabbi Joshua stood and stated, quoting Deuteronomy 30:12, "It is not in heaven." Rabbi Jeremiah said, "Since the Torah was already given at Mount Sinai, we do not listen to a divine voice, as you already wrote at Mount Sinai in the Torah to follow the majority." Exodus 23:2. Years later, Rabbi Nathan encountered Elijah the prophet and asked him, "What did the Holy One, blessed be he, do at the time of that debate?" Elijah answered. He smiled and said, "My children have triumphed over me. My children have triumphed over me." Finally, Judaism rebuked the notion of a corporeal God in ringing fashion. Judaism is anti-materialism. It specifically rejects the idea that what we can see is all there is, or that the spiritual must be made physically manifest. The second commandment bars Jews from making graven images. Jews are specifically enjoined to destroy idols. This isn't nearly as tolerant as paganism, but it is also less human-bound, less sensory. It requires us to reach beyond that which our senses perceive. We must think beyond our physical limits, and we must recognize our own limited thinking, since any description of God is bound to be physical, and thus homonymic rather than literal. The notion of a divine being who reaches out to humanity with words, who runs the universe according to certain rules, and who stands beside us, even if we can't see him, that places God within human reach, even if God will always lie just beyond us. God's expectations for man. Before the Bible, man was merely cosmic chattel, a speck being bruited about by the forces of the divine. The gods expected little of man beyond simple bribery. There was no linkage between what we would deem moral behavior and divine expectation. As Sags states, there were no doctrines in the sense of definitions of required belief, and accepted standards of conduct were not explicitly linked to religion. The gods were arbitrary. They were unchained to rules. This meant that human behavior wasn't tied to divine behavior. The Bible offered a different perspective. A singular God meant a singular standard for behavior. Consequences couldn't merely be attributed to the interplay between the various self-interested gods. Instead, consequences were life lessons, meant to teach us to be moral. Sin had consequences in the real world. Now, that didn't mean that every sin would be punished with a prompt and proportional consequence. God doesn't play whack-a-mole with human sin. But it did mean that following God's commandments would usually lead to better life results than doing the opposite. Polytheism argued that gods were holy, and thus human beings ought to serve them. Judaism argued that we ought to be holy in imitation of God. Why, then, does the Bible focus so much on seemingly pagan sacrifices? Because biblical sacrifices aren't designed merely to appease a higher power. They're designed to change us, to teach us something. Maimonides argues that sacrifices were originally designed to woo polytheists toward monotheism by repurposing an ingrained cultural ritual and directing it away from sheer appeasement and towards self-betterment. According to Maimonides, sacrifices are intended to remind us that we ought to pay for our sins ourselves, and that only the mercy of God allows us to escape that accountability. The Talmud openly acknowledges that we could use reason to learn certain character traits. Judaism suggests that we can, in fact, determine certain moral injunctions. Even ignoramuses, Judaism believes, can determine that there is a God and that murder is wrong, for example. But such learning is incomplete, Judaism holds. Reason can teach us how not to be bad, how not to harm others, for example. The seven Noahide laws that governed humanity before Revelation are all designed to minimize human cruelty. Bans on murder, theft, idolatry, sexual immorality, animal cruelty, cursing God, and the positive commandment to set up courts of law in order to punish crimes. And those Noahide laws are incumbent on everyone, regardless of whether they even know about the Bible, specifically because they're so perfectly obvious. But Revelation teaches us how to be good. It teaches us which values we ought to hold dear, which characteristics we ought to cultivate. Revelation is necessary to raise us beyond the realm of the mediocre. God, the force behind progress. History in many cultures has no beginning and no end. Greek thought saw the universe as permanent and moving in circular fashion. History would recur, grow, and decay. There could be no vision of a progression in history, an inexorable movement toward a better time or messianic era. Progress itself was, for many of the ancients, an illusion, or not even that. It was an idea that had no place in the rational universe. That view of history isn't unique to the Greeks. Ancient Babylonians believed that past, present, and future were all part of one continuous stream of events in heaven and earth. Gods and men continued ad infinitum. In Native American cultures, reality itself was circular. Sacred hoops and medicine wheels, in their seamless curvature, represent the cyclical, no beginning, no end, turn and turn again, mythic view of reality of Native American peoples. Hinduism sees history as circular. Buddhism sees time as without beginning and without end. The uniqueness of each moment essential to the notion of history is not clearly expressed in Buddhism. In this view, the gods are not interested in history. They may intervene, but only for their own purposes, and often in conflict with one another. In the Iliad, the gods routinely intervene to save their favorites, and even take sides in the war based on their own interests. But those interests are variable and unpredictable. The Trojan War takes on little historic importance, it generates no progress, nor do the gods ever evidence any intent to do so. The Bible takes a different view. The Bible immediately sets God in the context of a time-bound history. God exists outside of time, but he is intimately involved in creating progress. The Jewish creation story notes that God intervenes day by day to create new levels of complexity in the material world, and then he rests. When God intervenes in the world, it is to better the lot of mankind or to teach lessons. God inserts himself in history by preserving Noah and his family. He restrains himself from stopping history ever again by destroying his creatures, no matter their choices. God manifests himself to Abraham to send the first monotheist on a journey to a place Abraham doesn't know. And God then makes a covenant with Abraham to build him up into a great and mighty nation connected with a particular parcel of land, Israel. God chooses Abraham. He chooses Isaac. He chooses Jacob. And then he chooses the people of Israel to act as exemplars of morality across history, to spread his word with Moses as his prophet. You are to be holy to me because I, the Lord, am holy. And I have set you apart from the nations to be my own, God states in Leviticus 20:26. The story of history is the story of God's romance with his chosen nation, his decision to take that nation out of slavery and bring it forth into freedom, and to use that nation as a vehicle for the transmission of his message. Has any God ever tried to take for himself one nation out of another nation by testings, by signs and wonders, by war, by a mighty hand and an outstretched arm, or by great and awesome deeds, like all the things the Lord your God did for you in Egypt before your very eyes? But the plot has twists and turns. The story of humanity is a story of the romance between an honorable God and a straying nation. A nation that knows better, but must learn and relearn to love God once more, and a God who occasionally turns away his face, but waits patiently for his people to return to him. With each relearning comes progress, a movement toward that historical finish line. We are all part of the great drama of history, History gives us a place. It gives us a rationale. We may live as individuals, but we are part of the tapestry of time, and even if our thread comes to an inglorious end, God weaves with us. History, in short, can progress. It can progress because God cares about us as individuals and because he is invested in our history. And the eventual culmination of history will come with the universal recognition of God and his handiwork, with the Jews as the treasure jewel shining forth light from Jerusalem. As historian Paul Johnson writes, "No people has ever insisted more firmly than the Jews that history has a purpose and humanity a destiny. At a very early stage in their collective existence, they believed they had detected a divine scheme for the human race, of which their own society was to be a pilot. They worked out their role in immense detail. They clung to it with heroic persistence in the face of savage suffering. The Jewish vision became the prototype for many similar grand designs for humanity, both divine and man-made. The Jews, therefore, stand right at the center of the perennial attempt to give human life the dignity of a purpose." The most important verse in human history. Polytheism left little room for the individual to make his way in the world. This wasn't true for rulers, who were ranked among the gods themselves. They had freedom of action, being made in the image of the gods. In ancient Egypt, beginning with the 4th dynasty, 2613 BCE, Egyptian rulers were honored with the title Son of Ra, Ra being the foremost Egyptian god. In Mesopotamia, the tradition of kings declaring themselves divine began with Naram-Sin of Akkad in the 23rd century BCE. Self-deification continued intermittently for centuries, all the way down to Augustus, who was declared a god upon his death in Rome in 14 CE. The spark of the divine invested in great leaders allowed them freedom of action. Hammurabi, for example, describes himself this way at the outset of his code. "When Marduk sent me to rule over men, to give the protection of right to the land, I did right and righteousness in, and brought about the well-being of the oppressed." Epic heroes of the ancient myths are identified with the gods. Commoners never even appear in these narratives. Judaism fought the notion of human inequality before God tooth and nail. We are all created equal in our endowment with a certain level of free will. Perhaps the most important sentence ever penned was this, from Genesis 1:27. "God created man in his image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them." No longer was divine choice restricted to great leaders. In fact, God mocks such pretensions in Genesis 6:2, when he decides to flood the earth after the sons of the gods, the rulers, begin running roughshod over the rights of commoners, prompting God to scoff at the arrogant humans who are mortal. Instead of a ruling caste with the power of free will, now all human beings, each and every one of us, was granted the value of choice. God had stamped us all, breathed life into us, formed us out of the clay of the ground. The creation story itself is designed to demonstrate how the first man, Adam, used his innate power of choice wrongly, and we are all Adam's descendants. One of the most moving segments of the Bible takes place just before Cain slays his brother Abel. God sees that Cain is jealous that Abel's offering has been accepted, and passionately informs Cain, "Why are you annoyed, and why has your countenance fallen? Is it not so that if you improve, it will be forgiven you? If you do not improve, however, at the entrance sin is lying, and to you is its longing, but you can rule over it." This is a constant recurring theme. God lays out the importance of choice, of proper exercise of free will, in Deuteronomy. "See, I set before you today life and prosperity, death and destruction. For I command you today to love the Lord, your God, to walk in obedience to him, and to keep his commands, decrees, and laws. Now choose life, so that you and your children may live." Because we choose, we are God's partners in creation. We are signatories to a covenant with God, in which we must play our role and choose to abide by our commitments. Free choice is the central element here. When God brought the Jews out of Egypt and stood them before Sinai, he required them to sign on to the program. They made an affirmative decision to contract with God and did so without even waiting to hear the terms. "We will do and we will hear." Freely willed action preceded justification. What Jerusalem tells us and what it doesn't. Let's return to our original standard for happiness: individual purpose, individual capacity, communal purpose, and communal capacity. What does Judaism alone have to say about these necessary elements? When it comes to individual purpose, Judaism has quite a lot to say. Judaism says that God expects things of us, that He has standards for our behavior, that He demands our holiness, that He cares about our commitment. A human being on a desert island can find purpose in living the life God wants for him, and it is laid out for him through a series of rules to be found in His holy book. As King Solomon concludes in Ecclesiastes, the purpose of human existence is simple. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. In doing so, Ecclesiastes says, we will find joy. I know that there is nothing better for people than to rejoice and do good while they live. There is nothing better for a person than to rejoice in his work, because that is his lot. With regard to individual capacity, the Bible speaks clearly as well. The Bible states openly that we are free agents with the capacity to choose sin or holiness, and that we have the obligation to do so. We are holy. We are made in God's image. And we are equal in the capacity to act as godly creatures, although we may have different capabilities. The Bible also makes clear that our job is to use our minds to discover God, to seek Him out, to ask questions, to struggle with Him. We believe that God abides by certain rules morally, and that He has set out certain rules for the worlds He created. That life is not an arbitrary scheme of chaotic last-minute decisions made by a variety of gods fighting for supremacy. In terms of science, this notion, the notion of a predictable, discoverable God, is vital. The assumption of regularity in the universe's rules is vital for the development of Western civilization and for the development of science in particular. The entirety of science is based on the notion of looking for universal rules that govern the world around us. If the universe were a random agglomeration of unrelated events, governed by no higher logic, the scientific search would be rather frustrating. The Bible does not, however, set out the notion that our own search for universal truths will bring us closer to happiness. God is, in the Jewish view, the only universal truth. Jews seek out God and hold Him to His word, not ours. His standards of truth matter, not our own. The notion of a search for truth outside of God is foreign to biblical thought. How about communal purpose? Certainly, Judaism provides the notion of a communal purpose. God tells Abraham in Genesis, I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse those who curse you, and all the peoples on earth will be blessed through you. Never has a prophecy been truer. From one man in search of God in the wilderness came three monotheistic faiths that dominate humankind and shape human culture on the broadest possible scale. Judaism taught that communal purpose was both particular and universal, that we must live within our communities and model our behavior to others. Judaism said that the nation of Israel would serve as proof of God's provenance, as demonstration of God's place in history. The attitude of historical progress, coined by the Jews and adopted by Christianity, drives Western civilization as a whole. Barack Obama was fond of quoting Martin Luther King Jr., "The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice." He even had that quotation inscribed on a rug in the Oval Office. But King himself only thought the moral arc existed in the context of a religious narrative of history. Here's the original context in which King spoke those words. Evil may so shape events that Caesar will occupy a palace and Christ a cross, but that same Christ will rise up and split history into AD and BC, so that even the life of Caesar must be dated by his name. Yes, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. If history has a direction, it does so only if we have faith in a God who stands at the end of it, urging us forward. Finally, communal capacity. What does the Bible have to say about the best system for fulfilling individual and communal purpose? Surprisingly little. Judaism believes that power ought to exist in the first instance in the family, secondly, in the community of faith, and finally, in the government. Judaism is ambivalent at best about the notion of state power. The Bible separates powers between the Levites and a judicial system. In fact, the Bible expresses fear of divine monarchy repeatedly. Moses says that the people will choose to appoint a king. He doesn't say that God will mandate a monarch. He then spells out a series of restrictions to be placed on the king, ranging from limitations on wealth to restrictions on the number of wives, and concluding with an order that the king must write his own copy of the Torah so as to be reminded of his legal duties each and every day. The king must not consider himself better than his fellow Jews and turn from the law to the right or to the left. Once the Jews enter the land, they are ruled by judges for generations. The prophet Gideon explicitly declines to rule over the Jews, stating, "I will not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you." When the Jews finally decide to throw over the prophet Samuel for a king, Samuel warns that a monarch will impoverish the people and act as a tyrant, concluding, "In that day you will cry out because of your king, whom you have chosen for yourselves, but the Lord will not answer you in that day." Judaism has a healthy suspicion for centralized power. Criminal penalties require two witnesses who warn the perpetrator before the crime and then witness the crime. While religion has been used as cover for theological tyranny, there is ample basis in the Bible for the notion that various forms of state organization for purposes of enshrining both individual and collective purpose can work. That truth would become obvious during the pre-Enlightenment period, when widespread reading of the Bible would overturn centuries of theocratic power. In short, the Bible presents a fulsome view of human happiness, but one that requires further elucidation. The Bible tells us what God expects of us and tells us that we have the duty to fulfill those expectations. It tells us that we are special and that we are loved by an infinitely good, caring, and powerful being. It tells us that we have a duty to reach out to Him. The Bible makes God accessible. It brings God down to earth. In doing so, it offers man the opportunity to raise himself. But the biblical tradition does not stress the ability of people to reason a priori. Revelation stands above reason. And revelation alone is not enough. The soul with which God endowed man seeks the divine through reason, the uniquely human quality that lifts human beings above animals and places us at the foot of God's throne. To seek a higher moral purpose, human beings would have to cultivate their reason. For that, they turn to Athens. Chapter 3. From the Dust. There is a battle currently raging on college campuses regarding the role of the university. Is it to create a safe space for students to find themselves? Is it a place to experience the wonder of a wide variety of thought? Or is it a place to inculcate the basic thought underpinning Western civilization? In the past, the answer was clearly the last option. People went to college to be steeped in the classics. The founding fathers were well-versed in Latin and Greek. Their writing is replete with references to ancient literature. In 1900, half of all American public high school students were obligated to take Latin classes. But many current scholars and students find the classics trite and boring, old and hackneyed, ethnocentric and culturally stagnating. Jesse Jackson famously marched at Stanford in the 1980s, arm in arm with students, chanting, "Hey, hey, ho, ho, Western Civ has got to go." As of 2010, not a single top university required students to take a course in Western civilization. Only 16 even offered such a course. What happened? A generalized scorn for Western civilization itself led to a sharp critique of learning about the classics. Western civilization, in the view of many on the radical left, was a bastion of imperialism and racism. Students should be devoted to learning about those shortcomings rather than about the glories of ancient philosophy. In fact, study of ancient philosophy and civilization dramatically limits our understanding of the West's innate evils. Edward Said made this case most explicitly in Orientalism, in which he suggested that the legacy of Greece and Rome was one of othering the East, and that classicists were most concerned with the denigration of non-Western traditions. Furthermore, Westerners were forbidden from writing about Orientalist cultures. As outsiders, they were destined to pervert the teachings of these cultures. Education, in this view, is merely a different form of perpetuating power relationships, and focusing in on Western civilization thus contributes to ongoing tyranny. Better to ignore the classics in favor of a more well-rounded education focusing on various cultures. Now, there's nothing wrong with reveling in that which we can learn from a multitude of cultures. The Supreme Court's hearing room contains Moses, Hammurabi, Solon, and Confucius in its tableau of lawgivers. But to ignore the legacy of the Greco-Roman philosophical tradition is to perpetuate the lie that Western civilization brought us more exploitation than liberty. The promulgators of multiculturalism in education all too often aren't promoting breadth of learning, but lack of learning. This attitude reaches its apotheosis in the anti-classics movements we see on college campuses like Reed, where one student group lobbies against basic humanities courses because they allegedly perpetuate white supremacy. The texts that make up the Humanities 110 syllabus are Eurocentric, Caucasoid, and thus oppressive. This is a dramatic, deliberate misreading of the history of Western civilization, the greatest force for good in world history. That statement is not meant to ignore the myriad evils in which Western civilization has participated. But Western civilization has freed more people than any other by a long shot. It has reduced poverty, conquered disease, and minimized war. Western civilization is responsible for the economic betterment of the global population and for the rise in human rights and democracy. And that civilization has deep roots. Why should Americans bother to learn about ancient Greeks? Because the classical roots of Western civilization in Athens still have much to teach us. Athens teaches us what we are capable of doing as human beings. Athens teaches us that we have the ability to use our reason to reach beyond ourselves. Athens teaches us not only how liberty can flourish, but why it should. I've argued that without Jerusalem, there could be no West. Without Athens, the same holds true. Religious faith is empowering because it tells human beings that they are loved and that they have the capacity to choose between good and evil. But religious faith also requires us to acknowledge the inherent limits on human capacity. It requires us to say that there are things we will never understand, that we are earthly creatures bounded by dust. But if the project of Sinai was about elevating man above the animals by associating him with a godly mission and granting him a godly soul, the project of Athens was about elevating man using man's own faculties. Religion doesn't discount the capacity of mankind, of course, but that capacity is always secondary to God's will. Athens elevates man's capacity and makes it primary. Greek thought, of course, didn't think that man could overcome all. The notion of Greek tragedy revolves around man reaching for the stars, but being prevented from his aspirations because of his own inherent limitations. But the heroes of Greek legend are those who challenged the fates, seeking to glorify their own independence. Prometheus, Antigone, Achilles, even Socrates himself. As famed drama critic Walter Kerr puts it, tragedy speaks always of freedom. This tragic quest for knowledge is endemic to Greek thought. It is a tragedy shot through with hope. Plato's allegory of the cave is the most famous example of striving to reach the light. In that allegory, Plato paints a picture of men chained to a wall in a cave, prevented from seeing the source of light outside the cave. Their ignorance restricts them to the belief that the truth is nothing other than the shadows of artificial things. But a few noble people can be released from those bonds, acclimated to truth, and brought out into the light. Those happy few can then return to the cave and help build a truer society for their fellows. But they will risk the wrath of their fellow prisoners and may pay the ultimate price for having debunked popular notions of truth. Utilizing human reason to escape the cave and bringing knowledge of the light, that was the task of ancient Athens, a task uniting Plato, 428 to 348 BCE, and Aristotle, 384 to 322 BCE. The ancient Greeks gave us three foundational principles. First, that we could discover our purpose in life from looking at the nature of the world. Second, that in order to learn about the nature of the world, we had to study the world around us by utilizing our reason. And finally, that reason could help us construct the best collective systems for cultivating that reason. In short, the Greeks gave us natural law, science, the basis of secularly constructed government. Jerusalem brought the heavens down to earth. Athens' elevation of reason would launch mankind toward the stars. Finding purpose in nature. The first contribution of the ancient Greeks was the philosophy of natural law. We live in the physical world. The physical world has nothing to say to us about purpose or meaning. It's a bunch of stuff. Why should a bunch of stuff have any information to give us about how we direct our lives? We live in a world filled with things and facts. Facts do not determine values. A tree is not good or bad. It's just a tree. The world is filled with brute facts. We ourselves are brute facts with no capacity to rise above the basic realities of nature. That's the conclusion of many modern philosophers. It was also the conclusion of certain ancient Greeks, like Democritus, 460 to 370 BCE, a philosopher who lived contemporaneously with Plato and Aristotle, and believed that all of human life could be boiled down to fundamental particles of matter he called atoms. Nature was merely nature. Ethics takes a back seat. Plato, Aristotle, and the Stoics thought differently. Plato and Aristotle rejected Democritus's atomic theory. In their view, the human mind was freely capable of deciphering nature's rules, and they believed that those rules did, in fact, exist. We could determine rules and values from nature itself. Nature had a purpose, or the God behind it did. How could they reach such a conclusion? Their reasoning was simple and profound. They posited that virtually every object in creation is directed toward an end, a telos in Greek. The value of an object lies in its capacity to achieve the purpose for which it was designed. Facts and values aren't separate things. Values are embedded within facts. For example, a watch is virtuous if it tells time properly. A horse is virtuous if it properly pulls a cart. What does this mean for human beings? What makes a man virtuous is his capacity to engage in the activities that make him a man, not an animal. Man has a telos, too. What is our telos? Our end, according to both Plato and Aristotle, is to reason, judge, and deliberate. Plato put it this way in The Republic. Is there some work of a soul that you couldn't ever accomplish with any other living thing that is? For example, managing, ruling, and deliberating, and all such things. Could we justly attribute them to anything other than a soul and assert that they are peculiar to it? Further, what about living? Shall we not say that it is the work of a soul? Aristotle agreed. He believed that using our reason, we could determine the purpose of everything around us. Aristotle believed that everything in being relied on a rationale for its existence, in philosophy speak, a final cause. So, for example, the roots of a plant only exist to fulfill their final cause, providing nutrients to that plant. And our final cause is the use of reason. The work of a human being is an activity of soul in accord with reason. So, according to both Plato and Aristotle, what makes us virtuous is doing our job, looking at the world with our reason, discerning the final causes for which things exist. This is our purpose. Just as Adam is tasked with naming the animals in the Bible, so we are tasked with recognizing the telos of the world around us in Greek thought. The modern mind rebels at this notion, the notion of something's virtue tied to its inherent purpose. Nature, we believe, is blind and valueless. We don't blame a snake for biting or a baby for crying. But that's not what the ancients meant by virtue. They didn't mean our modern moral sense of virtue, being a nice person or something similarly vague. They meant fulfilling the telos for which you were created. Part of fulfilling that telos was the cultivation of those aspects of character that made you most human. Ancient systems of thought carried one significant difference from modern thought with regard to virtue. They focused on virtue in terms of character development. As Jonathan Haidt writes, where the ancients saw virtue and character at work in everything a person does, our modern conception confines morality to a set of situations that arise for each person only a few times in any given week, trade-offs between self-interest and the interests of others. Whereas modern systems of morality focus far more on whether given actions are good or evil, ancient ethical systems worried less about rules for action and more about making men and women virtuous people, people capable of fulfilling their telos as human beings, and utilizing reason and character to carry out complex moral equations. Now, this still leaves us with a problem. In order for us to share a community, we have to agree on our telos. As philosopher Leo Strauss suggests, no society can be built on a multiplicity of end goals. In order to avoid arguing incessantly over end goals, therefore, the Greeks had to posit an objective, underlying logic to the universe, a grand designer, an unmoved mover. Were the universe a chaotic, arbitrary, and random place, operating according to no design, it would have no telos. But if a grand plan stands behind all of creation, our job is merely to investigate that plan, to uncover the natural law that governs the universe. The ancients realized that any theory of telos had to rely on the presence of a designer. As such, they were philosophical monotheists, even if they were religious polytheists. Anaxagoras, 510 to 428 BCE, found a system of universal logic undergirding the world. He called it nous. Heraclitus, 535 to 475 BCE, was the first known philosopher to use the term logos to describe the system of unified reason behind the world we see and experience. Man could understand the universe because a force had created the universe. Man's mind mirrored that force to the extent that man could uncover its purposes. As historian Richard Tarnas writes, as the means by which human intelligence could attain universal understanding, the logos was a divine revelatory principle, simultaneously operative within the human mind and the natural world. And philosophers were tasked with uncovering this logos. By doing so, they would be fulfilling both their own telos and discovering the telos of mankind more broadly. The birth of science. This investigation led to the birth of science. The science and technology that has bettered our world, the iPhones college freshmen used to denigrate Western civilization, was built on Greek origins. The ancient belief that virtue was to be located in use of our reason necessitated the investigation of nature. The ancients believed that by studying the nature of things, we could discover the nature of being. While the biblical worldview said that God had created nature, it didn't have much to say about nature itself or whether investigating nature would lead to God. The Bible didn't even have a word for nature. The Hebrew word yetzer is the closest term, and that generally means will. But Greek philosophy was different. It suggested that the best way to investigate the nature of human purpose was to look at reality itself and attempt to discover the systems behind it. This made it imperative to investigate our universe in order to find a higher meaning. Pythagoras, 570 to 495 BCE, led this quest. He believed that human beings could achieve consonance with the universe by seeking to understand that universe. Pythagoras's philosophy led him to mathematics, an attempt to uncover the supposedly perfect harmony of the cosmos. And that led him to the Pythagorean theorem, among other discoveries. Plato and Aristotle both believed in the notion of objective truth as well. But Plato and Aristotle disagreed with regard to what constituted objective truth, the forms or knowledge of the physical world. In the end, this disagreement would wind up creating the basis for the scientific method. Deduction would present human beings with a scientific hypothesis. Facts presented by empirical evidence would become the basis for judging that theory. The hypothesis would then be accepted or rejected or changed. Aristotle's establishment of logical rigor with regard to empirical observation would provide the basis for all further scientific thought. The creation of reason-based government. Finally, the Greeks gave us the roots of democracy. Based on the notion of virtue, use of reason to act in accordance with nature, Plato, Aristotle, and the Stoics developed ethical systems. Those ethical systems didn't merely recommend personal cultivation. They also encompassed the creation of new forms of government. Some of their ideas regarding government were good. Others were bad. But they began the process of applying reason to governmental structures, a process that has continued down to our day. The ancients believed that in order to cultivate virtue, the polis, the city-state, must be at the center of human life. As philosopher Alistair MacIntyre points out, the Athenians universally believed that good citizenship was a prerequisite to being a good man. Plato's ethical system tied together happiness and virtue. The truly virtuous man will be happy. Plato defined various virtues too, justice, moderation, and the like. But these virtues aren't individual virtues in Plato's view. They only exist in the context of a community. The virtue of justice, for example, exists when each person fulfills his or her function in relation to the polis. Our virtues exist in relations with others. Because the polis is the context in which virtue is cultivated, and because cultivating virtue is the ultimate goal of man, the polis must be governed rigorously so that human beings are inculcated with virtue, according to Plato. That means that those who govern must be the best and wisest among us, that we must rigorously condition a class of philosophers to rule. Otherwise, chaos will ensue. Unless wrote Plato in The Voice of Socrates, the philosophers rule as kings, or those now called kings and chiefs, genuinely and adequately philosophize, and political power and philosophy coincide in the same place. There is no rest from the ills for the cities, my dear Glaucon, nor I think for humankind. In no other city would there be private or public happiness. In Plato's view, conflict within the state lies in failure of people to recognize their own station. To solve such conflicts, Plato set up a rigorous hierarchy in his utopian vision between workers, warriors, and philosopher kings. He also recommended a communistic version of his ideal state in which the philosopher kings are raised. This led philosopher Karl Popper to protest that Plato's ideal state was purely totalitarian and anti-humanitarian, and accused Plato of re-enshrining class rule and class privilege. The principle that every class should attend to its own business means, briefly and bluntly, that the state is just if the ruler rules, if the worker works, and if the slave slaves. In defense, Plato scholars Leo Strauss and Alan Bloom rejected Popper's critique by suggesting that Plato's entire scheme was at least partially facetious, an attempt to prove the unworkability of full communitarian control. Aristotle's system of virtue also involved one's status as a citizen. But unlike Plato, who believed that the forms could be understood by a select few, who could then rule benevolently over the rest of a well-organized society, Aristotle rejected such utopianism. He tore into Plato's suggested regime, calling it unrealistic and stating that it would rend apart the society itself. Let us remember, Aristotle says, that we should not disregard the experience of ages. Aristotle instead said that a regime combining aspects of democracy with aspects of aristocracy would be best, a clear philosophical iteration of a system of checks and balances. The logic of both Plato and Aristotle tied together the existence of the state to its ability to forward and abide by natural law. Their philosophical heirs, like Cicero, would express that view more fulsomely. Thus, Cicero writes in The Republic, "True law is right reason in agreement with nature. It is of universal application, unchanging and everlasting. It summons to duty by its commands and averts from wrongdoing by its prohibitions. There will not be different laws at Rome and at Athens, or different laws now and in the future, but one eternal and unchangeable law will be valid for all nations and all times, and there will be one master and ruler, that is, God, over us all, for he is the author of this law, its promulgator, and its enforcing judge." Cicero's elegant defense of what he termed a mixed system, a system of shared governmental responsibility in which citizens have a share in control of their government, checked by a monarch, checked in turn by an aristocracy, was treasured by the American founding fathers. This system, Cicero thought, would ensure the prevention of tyranny and the violation of virtue. What Athens tells us and what it doesn't. Yes, classical studies are still necessary. The college students who fulminate against them are undercutting the very foundations upon which they stand. They're ignoring reason, science, and democracy. We'll see later in this book just how that abandonment undercuts the strength of the West. But there is no question that without Athens, the West simply would not exist as it is, and that the world would suffer greatly for that fact. With that said, Athens alone is insufficient to explain the greatness of the West. The world of Athens has shaped us in profound ways, and it shapes us particularly strongly as products of a secular age. It's easier to spot our debts to Athens than our debts to Jerusalem. They seem to require less faith, less of a belief in the miraculous and the divine. But Athens wasn't enough. The West still required Jerusalem. To understand why, we must once again return to our fourfold framework for meaning: individual purpose, individual capacity, communal purpose, and communal capacity. In the Athenian framework, it's nearly impossible to disassociate individual purpose from communal purpose. Plato, Aristotle, and the Stoics would have all rejected such a division as counterproductive and fruitless. Individual purpose lay in acting virtuously, fulfilling our telos by pursuing right reason in accordance with nature. Virtue, in turn, could only be defined with reference to the community. The individual in this view tends to disappear into the community. Where the Athenians were tepid with regard to individual purpose in the absence of community, they were religious in their belief in individual capacity. They passionately advocated the notion of an order to the universe and insisted repeatedly that mankind had not just the capacity, but the obligation to uncover that order. Uncovering natural law meant seeking to know nature, and Plato, Aristotle, and the Stoics were united in their belief that human beings could turn their minds to nature in pursuit of answers. Humans were graced with a divine power, reason. The human mind reflected objective truths discoverable in the universe. Perhaps the most inspiring legacy of Athens is the unwavering faith in the power of the human mind. As already noted, communal purpose was wrapped up with individual purpose. If the goal of the individual was to find happiness through virtuous citizenry, the goal of the community had to be promotion of that virtue. In this communitarian vision, individual freedom in the modern sense completely disappears. Athens rejected the concept of individual freedom beyond the freedom to pursue the virtuous in pursuit of telos. Freedom merely meant self-control, the very opposite of what we often mean by freedom today. Freedom in the modern notion is explicitly rejected by Plato, who felt it would lead to anarchy. According to Aristotle, freedom only exists in the individual context when you are involved in philosophical pursuits. What then of communal capacity? The community was tasked with two separate functions, instilling virtue in the citizenry and protecting the citizens from the violation of natural law. Plato thought that fulfillment of the first function could prevent the necessity for the second. If the government could train perfect philosopher kings to govern, there would be no need to worry about violations of natural law. Aristotle and the Stoics both worried at such utopianism and believed that the state had to be designed to prevent the violation of natural law through a mixed system of checks and balances. The Athenian system of thought establishes certain fundamental notions crucial to happiness: the notion of telos, discoverable by us; the importance of reason-led investigation leading to the birth of science; the recognition that social ties bind us to one another. But Athenian thought still leaves several serious questions to be answered. The Greeks found happiness in philosophizing, not in action. If you aren't a philosopher, how do you achieve happiness? Are we really expected to be happy as workers or warriors in Plato's tripartite society? How do we avoid the tyranny of the polis, given the link between virtue and good citizenship? Most of all, how does philosophy translate over into action? Where the law of Moses is written in stone, the natural law often seems vague or even illusory. How can the world of thought be united with the world of practice? Could the thundering voice of God, demanding action from the mountaintop, somehow be linked with the quiet, questioning voice of the philosophers, demanding reason from nature? Chapter 4. Coming Together. The worlds of Jerusalem and Athens seemed largely irreconcilable. Judaism was a small but important religion. Estimates suggest that perhaps 10% of the Roman Empire was Jewish by the end of the 1st century CE. And Greek thought had largely been subsumed within the rubric of Roman thought. But the two building blocks of Western civilization, Judaic revelation and Greek reasoning, were at war. It was, at best, highly unclear whether consonance could be successfully attempted. There were three serious conflicts between Jewish thought and Greek thought. The first conflict surrounded the nature of God. The God of Moses and the God of Aristotle were not identical. Where Judaism posited an active God in the universe, Greek thought posited an unmoved mover, largely unconcerned with human affairs. The changeless, unmoved mover was the God of Plato and Aristotle, Jonathan Sacks says. The God of history was the God of Abraham. They simply did not belong together. Judaism believed, as Greek thought did, in a God who stood behind creation. But unlike Greek reason, Judaism also saw God's presence in human events, not merely nature. God was intimately involved in this view with man's action. The Greeks believed far more in fate than in a divine presence with a moral sense. Second, Greek reason sought universality in all things. Revelation found universality through the specific communication between God and man at Sinai. Greek natural law thinking centered around the notion that human beings could, through pure contemplation of the world around them, arrive at certain universal truths. Those universals were true for everyone and represented the ultimate level of knowledge. Jewish revelation, by contrast, suggested that human beings were not fully capable of discovering all universals, that revelation would be necessary, a voice speaking from on high to human beings dictating morality. Thus, the Torah suggested that God wanted human beings to use reason to find general truths, but that his chosen people had also been given additional responsibilities. That people was designated his light unto the nations to enact his commandments and, by doing so, spread those universal truths. Universalism suggests that human logic leads to the light outside the cave. Particularism suggests that God's hand can be found in his guidance of one particular nation. Third, Greek commitment to the polis contradicted Jewish commitment to the divine. The Greek vision of citizenship focused centrally on the place of the individual within the polis, the city-state. Hellenic thought focused heavily on how to shape individuals to best serve as citizens and how to cultivate virtues that would be useful in such citizens. Judaism, however, had another commitment, the commitment to individual and collective service to divine law. These two notions came into direct conflict in 167 BCE when the Greek king Antiochus IV attempted to defile the Jewish temple on behalf of the Greek religion and banned many Jewish practices. He used as his proxy Hellenized Jews who saw traditional Judaism as an obstacle to assimilation. The Maccabees rose up in revolt and reestablished the Hasmonean dynasty in Judea. That uprising is commemorated by Jews to this day in the form of Hanukkah. Could these two traditions be brought together? Could reason alone provide purpose? Could religion alone provide capacity? Or would the two find consonance? These questions would drive philosophy and religion for the next 13 centuries, transform the philosophy and history of the European continent, and provide the next layer of foundational ideas in the building of modernity. The birth of Christianity. The birth of Christianity represented the first serious attempt to merge Jewish thought with Greek thought. The Christian admixture was far more Jewish than Greek in its vision of God and of man's quest in the world, but it was also far more Greek than Jewish in its universality. Christianity universalized the message of Judaism. The Gospels were deliberately written in Greek, not the Aramaic used by the Jews of the period. Jesus' story was meant to extend to the entire world. Because Jesus was no longer a Jewish figure in the Christian view, but the material incarnation of the divine, that meant that Jewish law could be abandoned in favor of universalism. As historian Richard Tarnas writes, quote, "That supreme light, the true source of reality shining forth outside Plato's cave of shadows, was now recognized as the light of Christ. As Clement of Alexandria announced, by the Logos, the whole world is now become Athens and Greece." Unquote. The Judaic notion of God, so focused on law and the Jewish people as God's torch burning in the darkness through fulfillment of that law, was turned aside. Instead, Jesus became all. Christ is the culmination of the law, so that there may be righteousness for everyone who believes. If you declare with your mouth Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. For there is no difference between Jew and Gentile. The same Lord is Lord of all and richly blesses all who call on him. Access to God became universal and far more easily attainable. The answer lay in belief. This key Christian concept, the notion of faith in one personal Redeemer, the representative of God's logic in the universe, broadened the appeal of Judaism to billions of people over history in a way Judaism never would have. Christianity's focus on grace rather than works makes it a far more accessible religion than Judaism in a practical sense. The commandments of Judaism are intricate and difficult. Christianity dispensed with the need for them. Faith is paramount. In making faith paramount, however, Christianity demoted the role of Greek reason in the life of human beings. Despite Christianity's vision of God as the Logos, the logic lying behind all of the universe, Christianity conflated that Logos with the person of Jesus. The great early Christian thinker Tertullian, 155 to 240, summed up the idea well. What has Jerusalem to do with Athens, the church with the academy, the Christian with the heretic? After Jesus, we have no need of speculation. After the gospel, no need of research. Likewise, St. Augustine, 354 to 430, suggested that investigating the universe was a waste of time for those who accepted the truth of revelation. Many scholars engage in lengthy discussions on these matters, but the sacred writers, with their deeper wisdom, have omitted them. Such subjects are of no profit for those who seek beatitude, and what